Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning in to our 80th episode. You know, it's been interesting for me to look back at the evolution of the show. I created the forum as a way to tell stories about food and those fighting for it. But it was originally geared to educate the industry and our community about the importance of good sourcing. Over time, I've realized that the opportunity here was to broaden the aperture and to share these stories not just with those in the weeds, but instead to make each episode approachable and palatable by a broader, diverse audience. We welcome so many great guests to the show, true rock stars delivering solutions of change, and getting to sit down and pick the brains of some of the most prominent leaders in future food, agriculture, the environment, circular economies and systems thinking has been enlightening. It's been a true honor for me. I'm a better man for it, and I'd like to thank the listeners. And thanks for all the fun fan mail, excuse me. And the response to the show has been a bit overwhelming and a bit humbling. I guess, maybe equally humbling for me, is to realize that what I bring to the table is being a talk show host for this movement. But hey, that's okay. I'll take that role. We, at this point, need all hands on deck, and I'm ready to serve. I try to deliver by always doing my homework, by always coming prepared and trying to deliver captivating stories and engaging in conversation for our audience. And I'll do my best to continue to learn and improve. Now, as you've listened in the past, I start most of these episodes with a monologue that's applicable to the conversation at hand. Sometimes I get a bit verbose, but I do my best to keep it short and entertaining. One of my buddies calls these intros these ecological sermons. And just last weekend, a new listener sent me a note describing some of the show leads as being something out of the 1990s TV show Northern Exposure. And that's where the town poet Chris Stevens opens each TV episode making sense of the world through short vignettes on the radio show he hosts for the fictitious town of Sisley, Alaska. I guess whatever it takes. It's been interesting figuring out how to get sourcing messaging out to a broader and more diverse audience. A talk show is a proven formula. It's an approachable way to deliver new information in a cadence of knowledge share already consumed daily. It's created an opportunity for me to meet and engage with true agents of change who have dedicated their careers, if not their lives, to leave this place better than they have found it. And that's pretty good stuff. Today's show is no different. For our 80th episode, we welcome a global leader in food system reform set on addressing human suffering caused by malnutrition. Today, we welcome the executive director of the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, Dr. Lawrence Haddad. Hello, doctor. How are you today?
Hi, Aaron. I'm very well, thank you.
Well, thank you for taking the time. Now, you're based out of Geneva.
Actually, the headquarters is in Geneva, but I actually live in the UK. I'm talking to you from sunny Brighton on the south coast of the UK.
Oh, I've been there. That's beautiful. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing at the Global Alliance of Improved Nutrition, GAIN. Now, I was looking at your website and it said, according to a global nutrition report, about 88% of the countries suffer from two or three forms of malnutrition. And every day, 815 million people are going to bed hungry. And that's up from a number in 2015 that was 777 million. One in three people lack key micronutrients like iron and vitamin A needed to grow properly and to live their active lives and raise healthy families. And at the same time, 2 billion adults are overweight or obese, and 41 million children are overweight. Malnutrition now undermines billions of people's health and leaves 155 million children stunted every year. So, Dr. Haddad, if you could you tell us about what you're doing at GAIN to address these clear and present danger?
As you said, the numbers are scary, and I've read the numbers and I've generated the numbers and I analyze the numbers. And again, when you put them I line them up one after the other, they never fail to scare me. And to inspire me to act. Malnutrition is one of these things that we used to think sort of 30, 40 years ago. It was something that happened in Africa and Asia. And those of us who lived in North America and Europe were kind of fine. But with the rise of overweight and obesity and type 2 diabetes and hypertension and diet-related cancers, really everyone is affected by malnutrition. Every country in the world, as you said, one in three people. And that really changes the way we think about this set of problems. It's not something that rich countries have a monopoly on the solutions and the poorer countries have a monopoly on the problems. Everyone has the problems and everyone needs to come up with the solutions. And that's really the premise upon which the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, the organization that I lead, was set up 15 years ago. It's an international nonprofit, international NGO, non-governmental organization. And our job is to bring all parts of society together to deal with this problem of malnutrition. We recognize that governments have to lead, but this is such a big problem. Governments on their own can't resolve this. It requires governments, civil society, businesses, development partners from the United Nations and elsewhere to really come together and form a very strong alliance to defeat this big problem. And I would say at the center of all of those forms of malnutrition is poor diets. It's what we eat. A bunch of us are eating too little. A bunch of us are eating not enough of the right things, and then a bunch of us are eating too much of the wrong things. And when you look at the causes of all these forms of malnutrition, poor diet is the common denominator. Now, if you want to do something about poor diets, you have to dip your hands in and get your hands dirty in dealing with the food system. And the food system is a bunch of actors and their relationships. And it's everything from farmers and seed companies that shape what we grow through to consumers who demand certain types of foods and everything in between. The processors, the distributors, the storage companies, the cold chain companies, the retailers, the marketers, the advertising agents, and then the consumers. So you have to deal with the food system if you want to make healthy diet choices more available, more affordable, and more desirable. And that's what we're trying to do at GAIN. And so that means you have to work with governments, but you also have to work with businesses, because businesses are the main investors in the food system. So I would say the thing that sets GAIN apart from many other organizations is that we are very, I think, unapologetic about the fact that we need to engage businesses. We acknowledge that businesses are a big part of the problem in terms of making unhealthy food seem highly attractive and highly desirable, but we don't understand how you can create solutions without involving them, because they are the ones that take all of this stuff to scale through markets. So we have a healthy skepticism about business, but we also have a healthy constructive attitude about business as well. There are some businesses we just don't want to work with because they do the wrong things and they do it knowingly. And then there are some businesses who are trying to do the right things, and we want to really support them, make it easier for them to do more good things and make it harder for the businesses that are not doing helpful things, make it harder for them to do that. So that's what we do again. We bring governments, businesses, civil society together to craft solutions in the food system that really make nutritious food, things like fruits, vegetables, pulses, nuts, some dairy, some kinds of fish, some kinds of meats. We want to make that stuff cheaper and more available. And actually, crucially, we want to make it desirable. We want to make it aspirational and convenient. And that's what we try to do.
So, as you mentioned, we're 15 years into GAIN, and it was originally spawned from what I read out of the UN. Are we making headway? Are you seeing improvements with multi-stakeholder initiative?
In some types of malnutrition, we're seeing really quite promising declines. There's a type of malnutrition that is really kind of an all-purpose measure of malnutrition, and it's called stunting. And it affects kids. It's really noticeable in kids under the age of 5 years of age. And if you didn't know anything about a region and you went to, a region in, Malawi, which is a country in southeastern Africa, if you went to a rural area in Malawi, you might see the kids there and you might think they look fine, because they're none of the obvious pictures of malnutrition that you might see in a UNICEF ad, for example, where kids are literally skin and bone, terribly, terribly, terribly thin, painfully thin. You won't see that in many places. You'll see kids who look fine. And you might think those kids are 5 years of age, but they're actually 9 or 10. And that's because they're stunted. They're much shorter than they should be. Now, there's nothing intrinsically valuable about being tall or short. Being short, if every kid in the village is shorter than they should be, then that means that not only is their height not developing properly, but their brains aren't developing properly, their immune systems aren't developing properly. Their hardware and their software is not developing properly. And that means that they will be more likely to die before their fifth birthday. They're more likely to learn less in school, and they're more likely to earn less when they grow up and to be adults. And they're also more likely, strangely enough, to develop things like diabetes and hypertension later on in life. So these types of malnutrition, the stunting kids, we have seen this come down quite steadily and quite rapidly, not rapidly enough to meet the global goals, the sustainable development goals, but quite rapidly. And certainly in some cases, we've seen big decreases. Some Indian states, Bangladesh in South Asia has posted some impressive reductions recently, as has Indonesia and Ghana and Kenya. So this is good news. Some forms of malnutrition seem highly impervious to any attempts to reduce them. Anemia in women between the ages of 15 and 49, that number doesn't seem to be coming down very rapidly at all. It's quite static. We think, we know it's got something to do with eating food that's rich in iron, but we know there are other factors that are driving anemia numbers in women. Malaria has something to do with it. An infection has something to do with it. And then there are types of malnutrition that are just skyrocketing everywhere. Obesity, overweight, diabetes type 2. And I travel a lot to African countries, and I travel a lot to South Asia, because GAIN has 9 country offices. And I talk to policymakers and CEOs a lot, and I'm always surprised that they want to talk first and foremost about obesity and overweight and diabetes. And this is despite the fact that the levels of the problem in their country are quite low. What's grabbing their attention are two things. Firstly, the numbers are increasing quite rapidly, even though they're from a low base. And secondly, the fact that people they know, and actually sometimes themselves or people in their family, are affected by these types of malnutrition. There would be very few politicians whose families are affected by kids who are so thin, you know, you couldn't bear to look at them, or kids that were so stunted. But they probably have someone in their family who has diabetes or is overweight or obese or has hypertension or who has suffered from a stroke. So that makes the issue very live for them. And in obesity and overweight and these kinds of diet-related chronic diseases, they're increasing everywhere. They've plateaued in some countries, but they're not coming down. And in other countries, they're going up. And that's driven by a whole range of things. It's driven by urbanization, which means that people are buying foods that are more convenient and more pre-prepared, and they tend to be higher in unhealthy types of foods. Salt, sugar, salt, fat is being driven by income growth, which means that families are able to buy a little bit of little bit more packaged foods, and some packaged foods are not very healthy. And it's being driven by increased exposure to irresponsible marketing that makes foods seem like they're healthy and good for you, but in reality they're not. So on the undernutrition side, you know, not enough food, not enough of the right type of food, we're making progress, but we need to put our foot on the accelerator. And on the other types of malnutrition, the ones where we're eating too much of the wrong things, we somehow need to put the brakes on that, because that's running away.
The impact of the Western diet, it's the gift that keeps on giving, right?
It's got a lot to do with that. Yeah. But unfortunately, many middle and low-income countries are developing their own unhealthy diets too. So it's there's something to do with the Western diet, but it's part of the, it's driven less by Westernization, I would say, and more by urbanization and income growth.
Interesting. So I saw from your website that you have 10 programs that you offer from GAIN.
Yeah.
Food fortification, nutritious food financing, nutritious food marketplace, adolescent nutrition, improving children's diets, just to name a few. So with all of these countless problems throughout the globe, how does your organization decide where to allocate your resources and what specific issue to go after?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are kind of two types of organizations. There's the organization that just does analysis, policy analysis. They think, they influence, they advocate. They're really important. There are think tanks and policy analysis institutes. They're very important. They help shape ideas. Then there are organizations that do a lot of implementation. They're on the ground delivering food, delivering nutrition programs, and they're also obviously very important. And we, again, we try to be both of those things. We try to have a on-the-ground presence in 9 countries, 5 in sub-Saharan Africa and 4 in Asia, 3 in South Asia and 1 in Indonesia. And we try to have really meaningful programs that deliver impact at scale to people in those countries. You know, we can only do so much. We're a medium-sized NGO, even though we're working in alliance with hundreds and hundreds of other partners. We have to use the partnerships to also influence policy and legislation and ideas and markets. So we have a very clearly defined strategy of making a difference on the ground. By doing that, we really understand the realities, the context, we get our hands dirty, and we're able to use that experience to really advocate effectively for governments and businesses to do things differently to allow more of the kinds of things we do to really flourish and catch on and catch fire and be transmitted to others. So the kinds of programs we operate, there are sort of 3 types of programs. And Aaron, you must tell me if this is too much detail, but the 3 types of programs. One is a kind of program that's called large-scale fortification. And this is really a program that can reach hundreds of millions of people. And the basic premise is that people eat cereals pretty much every day, even low-income people. They eat rice, wheat, maize pretty much every day. They don't eat much else, but they eat this every day. Now, the medium-term goal is to help them generate more income so they can diversify their diets and add a little bit of fish or add some fruits and vegetables or a little bit of meat to their otherwise incredibly monotonous, tasteless food every day. But in the short run, what we can do is fortify the rice and the wheat and the corn flour with vitamins and minerals, things like iron and zinc, vitamin A and vitamin D. We can also do this with cooking oil because everybody pretty much uses cooking oil, vegetable cooking oil. So we work with governments and businesses to add those, they're called micronutrients, the vitamins and the minerals. We add it to the things people consume every day. So that in that way, we can reach, we're currently, our programs and our partners are currently reaching about 150 million people every day with this kind of food, fortified food. And so that's good and that's important, but it's just a few micronutrients that are reaching people. And nutrition is about more than a few micronutrients. Nutrition is about food and diverse food. So the second type of program we operate is designing targeted programs to children, adolescents, and actually workers who work in the labor force, either for a government or for a big company. Very often they are very undernourished, and we will design programs with governments and businesses to reach the workforce, the adolescents, and the children. I'll give you an example. In Bangladesh, we're working with an adolescent youth movement. The adolescents themselves are signing something called a pocket money pledge. So adolescents in Bangladesh get a little bit of pocket money. It's nothing really. It's 10 cents a day equivalent. But in Bangladesh, it allows you to buy a snack every day. And so we're getting, with this adolescent movement in Bangladesh, we're encouraging a million adolescents to sign something called a pocket money pledge. Now, this pledge says for every, all of our pocket money, we pledge to allocate a certain proportion of it to healthy foods. So they're signing this pledge. They're doing it through paper at school, where the ones that have access to social media are doing it through an app that is being developed. In a few months' time, 10,000 of these adolescents are going to conduct a peaceful, respectful march to the government houses in Dhaka, which is the capital of Bangladesh. And they're going to say to the government, we have collaborated, we have put together all of our pocket money, and we are prepared to spend it on healthy food. What are you, the government of Bangladesh, what are you going to do to make it easier for us to buy healthy food in our schools, in our clubs, in our neighborhoods? They're also going to go to a whole series of food companies and retail outlets, and they're going to say, we've put together a whole range of our pocket money, and we've constructed a big income shock that we can spend this income on your products, or we can spend this income on the products of your competitors. What are you going to do to make it easy for us to spend our pocket money, our collectivized pocket money, on your products? So GAIN is supporting this piece of work. It's supporting the adolescent movement around what is a nutritious food. It's supporting the development of the app and the petition collection. It's supporting the engagement with the government. So we are working with the government. Government is saying, well, what can we do to respond to the adolescents? And the businesses are also saying, what can we do to respond to the adolescents? So we are working with all three of those groups to try to come up with a solution, a set of solutions to make it easier for adolescents to purchase healthy food with their pocket money. And the reason we're focusing on adolescents is that we feel that, you know, adolescents are agents of change. It must be a co-created type of movement with them, because once GAIN leaves, You know, the movement needs to keep going and going from strength to strength. So this is a very tangible example of something we hope far-reaching consequences for adolescents. So that's the second type of program. The third type of program is really kind of supporting small businesses. Small businesses are very important for people who are malnourished. That's where they buy their food. They buy it from small fruit and vegetable people, small chicken outlets, small fish outlets. That's small peanut butter outlets. That's where they buy their nutritious food. They don't buy it from big supermarkets. The middle-income families who are slightly less malnourished, that's where they buy their food. But for the lowest-income people, they buy their food from small and medium enterprises. Small and medium enterprises in Africa and Asia are stuck. They are too big for microfinance, and they're too small for big banks to get loans. They want loans. They want to grow their business. So we will raise funds either from governments or foundations or from high net worth individuals. We will channel those funds to small and medium enterprises in the countries we work in to help them expand their businesses. If they have a business in fruits and vegetables, we want them, instead of selling 10,000 units a month, we want to help them sell 1 million units a month. And we want to help them sell those units at a lower price so more people can afford them. We'll also work with them to improve quality and safety as well. So that's the third kind of work, supporting small and medium enterprises. And the fourth kind of work is really working with governments to make the enabling environment more friendly. And I'll give you an example. In Nigeria, we were working with some companies that were telling us they were doing some fantastic work around mobile cold storage units that you can tow from a tractor. You can take this mobile unit, tow it on a tractor, take it from farm to farm, load up the food into this mobile storage unit, which keeps food at about 10 degrees centigrade. You then take that unit to a market somewhere, maybe 50 or 100 kilometers away. Much less of the food will perish. Much less of the nutrients will be lost. Farmers can get a better deal. Consumers can get more nutritious food because perishable food tends to be nutritious food. I said to the managing director, this was in Nigeria, you've got a fantastic business model here. Why don't you get some serious financing behind it and get a loan from a bank? And he said, I can't get a loan from a bank. I said, why not? It's not because you're too small. You're big enough to get a loan from a bank. He said, it's because we recycle our machinery. They get these shipping containers that you see on these big freight freight ships, and they cut them down to size, and that's what they use for these mobile cold storage units that can be pulled by a tractor. He said, I can't use that as collateral for the bank loan. Why not? Because in Nigeria, banks don't allow you to use reused equipment for collateral. It has to be new equipment. So there you have a really good example of a financial regulation that is having an unintended consequence. It's stopping a business that wants to reduce food loss and food waste and make more nutritious food available to more people. It's stopping it getting a loan, and it's really sort of an inadvertent law that's cramping the style of this business. And that's what we call, it's part of an enabling environment. We need to make the environment more enabling for businesses. So those are the four kinds of things we do. This large-scale food fortification that reaches hundreds of millions of people, but only with a few micronutrients. It's vitally important, but it's only a few micronutrients. Then there's the targeted programs at the most vulnerable, the adolescents, the children, the workforce. The third bucket is really, really focused on small and medium enterprises. What can we do? The ones that are producing nutritious food, not junk food, but nutritious food, how can we help them grow and really shape their national food systems? And the fourth bit is, how can we work with governments to make it easier for businesses who want to do the right thing to do the right thing.
Sounds like a good combination of enabling and empowering individuals to also take the ownership of that. And I'd actually like to pull that thread a little bit more. You had mentioned earlier in the conversation about engaging larger corporations and being part of addressing malnutrition. So last year, you penned an article in Nature describing a proposed solution that incorporates and incentivizes food companies to address nutrition concerns. You argue that the governments must provide incentives for businesses to fix the global food system and not just punish them for acting irresponsibly. And you describe how food companies can use their vast reach and marketing dollars to make change through a carrot and a stick. So could you tell us a bit more about your five-step plan that you're using to encourage this multi-stakeholder initiative?
The big food businesses are, they're seen primarily as a big part of the problem for malnutrition right now. They're pumping out too many low-cost sugary drinks, sugary products, too many salty foods, too many foods that are high in trans fats. And the predominant way of addressing that through public policy is to tax and regulate. And that's absolutely essential because taxing and regulating, companies have to pay attention to that. But I think that's sort of the bare minimum. I think in addition to that, you need to reward the companies that are saying, well, look, I just don't want to be punished. I don't want to be told what I can't do. I actually want to contribute to this problem beyond sort of not doing bad things. I want to do good things, but doing good things inevitably results in a commercial loss. I have to take a hit commercially if I want to do a good thing, because companies will often say, well, I'm just driven to where consumers want me to be. I'm just responding to consumer demand. If consumers want junk food, I will provide them with junk food. Now, there's some truth to this because consumers are voting with their wallets. On the other hand, it's a bit disingenuous because big companies, of course, shape that demand. They have a lot to do with what that demand looks like. Nevertheless, they're not the sole determinants of the demand. So if they were to produce a product with slightly less sugar or slightly less salt, or a product that has more vegetables in it and less animal product in it, they probably will be punished for it by consumers who will buy less of it because they say it doesn't taste as good, or it doesn't have the same feel, or it doesn't look as good, or it's not as delicious. So governments, and then therefore they'll be at a commercial disadvantage. So governments have to generate incentives for all companies to do more positive things. So one example of things they could do is many governments around the world set up export processing zones for their companies. They want to generate foreign exchange. And the way they can do that for their country is to help their companies sell to export markets overseas or on next door. And they do that by creating these business parks or export processing zones where if you're producing for export, your taxes are lower, or you have to pay less for your electricity or your water or your land rates. There's absolutely no reason the governments cannot do the same thing for companies that want to produce more nutritious food for domestic markets. In fact, we're in conversation with a couple of governments to try to set something like that up. Another example of how governments can change the rules of the game for companies. Governments spend a lot of money subsidizing agricultural research and development, but they actually end up subsidizing crops that are not particularly the crops with the most micronutrients, the most vitamins and the minerals in them. Very few agricultural research and development dollars or rupees or pesos go into improving the productivity or the resilience or the disease resistance of fruits and vegetables. Very little money goes into that. I don't really understand why. I think it's something to do with the political economy. Maybe the producers of fruits and vegetables are not aggregated sufficiently to be able to exert political power on public policymakers. So that's another example of how a government can make it easier for the producers of those fruits and vegetables to improve productivity, drive down prices, but still preserve the profitability, and in fact improve the profitability of those fruits and vegetable producers, and therefore make fruits and vegetables cheaper for food processors to use in their products. So those are just two examples of what governments could do. They could also make certain healthy products much cheaper for the consumer. So price incentives work best when there's a tax on things like sugar. Make sugary drinks 10 to 15% more expensive, but also at the same time make healthier foods 10 or 15% cheaper through price policies. In the UK, there's a value-added tax, which is like a sales tax, and every kind of food except for the worst junk food is exempt from that sales tax. But again, you could imagine sales tax being imposed on foods that were of moderate unhealthiness and completely free for fruits, vegetables, beans, that kind of fresh foods, whole foods. You can imagine that. So governments are often the biggest purchasers of food from the private sector in their country, because they need to provide food for their hospitals, their schools, their prisons. Many governments, on the one hand, advocate for healthier food, and on the other hand, don't practice what they preach. They don't purchase healthy food for their public systems. So there's lots of things that governments could do to incentivize and set the tone for businesses to then follow. And in many ways, a lot of the irresponsibility for the current diets that people eat is either placed at individuals' feet or it's placed at the feet of businesses. But I think a lot of it is to do with governments not taking this issue seriously enough and not being activist enough and saying, right, we're going to create the incentives for businesses and consumers to consume a healthier diet. And they don't want to do that because then they'll be accused of being in the UK we call a nanny state. No, I'm telling you what you should eat. That's not the case. It's just what you need to do is create the incentive so that people still have the liberty to do whatever they want, but the incentives to do things that are healthier, they have a stronger incentive to do so.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's those type of corporate and government relationships are riddled throughout all parts of economies. So, I mean, it is a unique opportunity to engage those different players. So I wanted to share with our audience that in June of 2018, the World Food Prize Foundation awarded Dr. Lawrence Haddad the 2018 World Food Prize. It's a very prestigious award. In fact, it's been called the Nobel Prize of Food and Agriculture. When we had your co-recipient, Dr. Nambaro, on Sourcing Matters, it was prior to him receiving last year's award. So first of all, congratulations on that. It's a huge success. But could you tell our listening audience a bit more about the award? And does that open up new channels for you and GAIN to do more great good?
Thank you for your congratulations. It was really a great honor to be awarded this along with my friend and colleague David Nambaro. The World Food Prize was set up by a man called Norman Borlaug, who was the Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1970. He's from Iowa, and he pioneered techniques that allowed corn, wheat, rice yields to triple, double, quadruple, increased by multiples of you know, huge numbers. At the time, this is in the 70s, to deal with what was then the predominant problem in malnutrition, which was global hunger. People just not getting enough even of the basic cereals to fill their bellies, and literally hungry every night, night after night. So this was the big challenge. It's still a big challenge. There are still 800 million people who are chronically hungry. But as we said at the, as you said in the intro, there's about 2 or 3 billion people who are malnourished in one way or another. So back in 1970, he said there needs to be something like a Nobel Prize for people working on food and agriculture. And he set up and found some private backers, and they set up the World Food Prize Foundation, which I think began in the mid 1980s, and the World Food Prize, which was given out to an individual or collection of individuals that had advanced the supply of food to the most people in that particular year or in that particular decade. What was so gratifying about this year's award was that it's really the first time that two out-and-out nutrition people have really won the award. It's the first time for a long time, let me put it that way. And I think it really testifies to the salience, the importance, the resonance that the issue of malnutrition has, even with a group of individuals and the selection committee who are predominantly focused on agriculture and food production. This idea that it's no longer enough to feed the world, but you have to nourish the world. Those are two very different things. Feeding the world is getting bellies filled, and that's really important. If you've ever been hungry on a prolonged basis, you'll know how important that is. But nourishing people and nourishing the world and doing it sustainably is so important for personal growth, for economic growth, for preventing mortality and morbidity, for nations, for a globe, the globe's development. And so for me, obviously it was very nice and a great honor to receive that prize on a personal level, but it was also really encouraging because the issues that David and I care about so much, about going beyond calories to look at where do the calories come from, and are they associated with vitamins and minerals? And are the right people getting the right food at the right time? That issue, the recognition for that was very important. Has it opened doors for me and for GAIN? I think David and I were pretty well known in the field before, but of course it has helped us. It has brought our achievements and most importantly the issues to a greater degree of recognition. And so who don't think much about malnutrition are coming more and more into our orbit and into the orbit of malnutrition. And that's really important. Kinds of, certainly in Europe, the kinds of recognition we're seeing today for the drive to reduce the consumption of and the use of non-renewable plastics, the kinds of movements we're seeing around climate change, with school children leaving their classrooms every Friday afternoon, including my own children, the movements we're seeing in the street of things like Extinction Rebellion, these kind of movements that are puncturing a collective consciousness, making it onto the main headlines of the evening news on mass media and not just in niche outlets on the internet and social media. This is very important. We're not there yet with malnutrition. We're not there. And David Nabarro and I, it's our mission to make sure that evidence-based nutrition messaging about why this is so important makes it a public sphere. So we we have a whole range of messaging. If you care about universal health coverage, you should care about malnutrition, because malnutrition, six of the top 10 risk factors for mortality and morbidity in whichever country you live are related to diet. If you care about conflict and preventing conflict, you should care about malnutrition, because in all the conflict areas, affected areas, you'll see before conflict erupts, you'll see a fluctuation in the availability and the price of food. If you care about a demographic dividend, this is where you have lots of young people entering the labor force at a peak number, in usually in Africa, it'll be in 15 or 20 years' time, you should be caring about what we're investing in their diets right now, because the people, the kids under the age of 5 right now, if they're not malnourished properly now, they won't be as productive in the labor force when they hit the labor force in 15, 20 years' time. So we're trying to link malnutrition to all of these issues, and it's not difficult, because you know, malnutrition, it's often, if any of your listeners like gardening, they'll know that if you plant your plants too early, or if your seedlings come up too early, frost will get them. Frost will kill them, and it will stop them dead in their tracks. And that's what malnutrition is like. It's like a frost that descends on young children, and it just affects them permanently. It's irreversible. It damages their brains. It damages their immune system. It damages muscle and bone formation. It damages their life chances permanently. And so we have to somehow create a sense that this is a problem that affects all of us, and it doesn't just affect us directly, it affects us indirectly, and we can all do something about it. So it has opened up new avenues in terms of new interviews, new types of partners, where it's much easier now, I think, for David and I to talk to people who never really think about malnutrition. We can at least get an audience with them. We can talk to ministers of planning and finance. We can talk to high net worth individuals. We can talk to CEOs that we probably would not have been as easy to have conversations with. And we can begin with our colleagues and our partners to begin to convince them that investing in nutrition is in their direct interest as well as everyone's indirect interest.
Very well put. Dr. Haddad, where could our listening audience learn more about what you're doing at GAIN? Is the website the best place?
The website is the best place, and the website is full of blogs and articles. Many of your readers will, you know, like me, the things that are outside of my immediate area of interest, I only have the patience to read 500 or 600 words. And there are lots of 500 or 600 word articles on the GAIN website about issues that are really relevant from day-to-day people. So we have an article just published yesterday on the GAIN website by me and a colleague on, you know, why on earth should we even bother with engaging with businesses? A lot of people say you're just kind of selling your soul and you're being naive about it. Well, we've got an article today that says this is why you should do it. Another short video clip that's up there is, what's the connection between climate change and nutrition? Another video clip is, what's the connection between nutrition and if you care about women's empowerment issues, which everyone should? What are the connections? Why should you care? There's another article there about eating meat. You know, there was a big recent report from the Lancet journal, supported by the EAT Foundation, which is very controversial, about what we should all be eating. Well, we deconstruct that report a little bit, and in plain English we say what it means if you live in Africa or Asia or Europe or North America. It's really targeted to the interested reader and listener, and to the more informed reader and listener. There's more technical stuff as well, but this really is an issue that affects everyone. Everyone can do something about it. If you're living in a neighborhood where your schools are are producing, are serving non-nutritious food to your kids or to the kids in your neighborhood, talk to your school principals about it. Talk to the school board about it. If your jurisdiction doesn't allow food banks to operate, it makes it hard for food banks to operate, talk to your local congressman or congresswoman about it. Talk to your mayor about it. There's things that we can all do, no matter where we live, that can make poor nutrition an anachronism, something we used to think about. I mean, our goal is in 20 years' time, we want to be having discussions with our grandchildren and our children's grandchildren about, do you remember the time when everybody ate all that junk food? What that was like? We want to be having those discussions. I don't know if I'll be old enough, if I'll be alive to have discussions with my kids, grandkids, but I hope so.
Yeah.
But those are the discussions we want to be having. We want to, if it hadn't already been used for poverty, we want to make malnutrition history.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a unique opportunity. We make a similar type of alignment here of calling it the steroid era of food and moving past that, so that we would all look back and chuckle on the fact that that's how we used to provide sustenance to ourselves. And I'll just close by saying the takeaways that I've received from this conversation, which is very enlightening and very interesting. And as the talk show host, I get to talk at the end here and talk about the fact that it's intriguing to know that getting the word out to the mainstream that nutrition is a framework of change is essential, that enabling and empowering more stakeholders to take part in this solution is in everyone's best interest. And things like focusing on fortification of food to address the low-hanging fruit, the real problems, some of these intrinsic problems, and to focus on kids and creating a movement and momentum behind that, working with small businesses that are on location and have a vested stake in solving these problems, engaging with governments, and getting more user-friendly and policy-friendly programs set up, and then obviously focusing on nutrition, evidence-based nutrition, and not just more energy production to fill bellies is the key parts moving forward. And as you said, Dr. Haddad, the fact that we have to work with businesses, the cat is out of the bag, so let's get to it. Let's start solving these problems through creative solutions where we all have a similar end zone, similar goal line. And that's where I think we're going to get things to change. And I hope I was able to summarize a lot of things that you said in this conversation. But I'll just say that I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with our audience today. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron. That was a fantastic summary. Thank you.